Well, hello there, fine people. Dave Morales here. Thanks for tuning in to Tapped In, where we sit down with people that are important to the local brewing scene. This podcast is an extension of the Bellingham Tap Trail, and today we'll be sitting down with Dave Vitt, founder of Culshen Brewing. We talk about how Culshen was a big risk that was ultimately very well-timed, how his vision of what it would be was blissfully naive, and just what it takes to helm not one, but two locations and stay relevant. But you know what? Today's Tapped In conversation is brought to you by Hoppus Real Estate, specializing in Whatcom's core neighborhoods, understanding the wants, and fulfilling the needs with community, craft, and comfort in mind. Located at 1012 DuPont Street across from the Lettered Streets Coffee House. You can find them on Facebook and Instagram. So Dave's a genuinely good dude, and it was really fun to sit down and track his path to where Culshen is now, get some insight as to where the local scene is going, and just shoot the breeze. So enjoy.
So I've done a little bit of research on you. Basically just what I can find online from interviews that you've already given.
Okay.
And I know that you're a Whatcom County native. Are you a Bellingham native as well?
Well, I went to school in Bellingham, but I grew up down South Lake Sammish, Alger area.
Okay.
So kind of in no man's land down there. And my dad... my grandpa and my dad and their family moved up here in the 60s at some point. And grandpa was a school teacher at Whatcom Middle School. And he had a jazz quartet that that he did about four nights a week down at the yacht club. And so my dad pretty much did his whole adult career here. As an auto glass guy, and I kind of followed in his footsteps for a while doing that. And so, yeah, I've been around here pretty much my whole life. And
nice.
Yeah.
And, yeah, speaking of your dad, one of the quotes that that you gave from your dad is one that I use as well, and I've never heard anybody else use it, and that's... beer has food value, but food does not have beer value.
Yeah. It's an instant classic.
Yeah. Yeah, I love it. I was like, oh, that's the first time I ever heard that from somebody else. Like,
Mickey Vitt original there.
Yeah. Nice Mickey Vitt. I like that.
Yeah.
And so was your dad a home brewer?
You know, he actually did do some home brewing.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that I can, sure, it inspired me. He made wine. I remember him making wine as a kid, when I was a kid. And, you know, we had these carboys of strange things in the basement that later I would, sneak out into the woods with my friends when I was old enough to do that. And,
so 10.
Yeah, exactly. So he did. He did a little bit of home brewing. I can't say that he ever made any really great beer, but he made beer.
Yeah. Yeah. My grandparents used to make Mustang grape wine down in Texas, and most of it was vinegar. But every once in a while, a batch would come through.
Yeah.
It was pretty sweet. But I was never actually a part of that, unfortunately. So you got the bug in like around 2000, is that right?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah. Was it friends or like what was the drive there? I mean, other than you're seeing that your dad was doing it and that it was possible, was it friends or was it just curiosity on your part?
Well, I think it started out as curiosity. I don't recall any of my friends actually home brewing now that I'm thinking about it. It was the classic, you know, girlfriend got me a homebrew kit kind of thing.
Nice.
And it sort of started there. And, I've always been into kind of handcrafted stuff, you know, making things is really what I like to do. And so that it just worked out pretty good because I like beer a whole lot and I like making things. And
so you were already an enthusiast at that point. How old were you?
Oh, I think I started drinking craft beer when I was... oh, in my, 17, 18, I remember at the time it was, you know, Killian's Irish Red and Henry Weinhardt's, you know, Private Reserve and all of these things. And then Bridgeport IPA was a big deal.
Mm-hmm. R.I.P. Bridgeport.
Yeah. Which, thinking back, I think that was a really good beer.
Mm-hmm. I loved Bridgeport's beers. Yeah. It was sad. There was some other breweries that were like, oh, if I had to, and I don't want any of them to go under, but there were some that I could have lost and kept Bridgeport.
Right.
Not just a victim of being there first.
Yeah.
Seems like.
Yeah. So, yeah, that kind of turned into Fat Tire and, oh, Dead Guy Ale. That was back. That was that was in my teens. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I was definitely into it before it was before I was supposed to be, but.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's the beautiful thing is you can buy all the ingredients.
Yeah.
Illegally. It's just putting them all together to make beer. That's when it becomes nefarious.
Right. Yeah.
That's funny. Do you remember your very first brew? Like how it turned out? I mean, so your girlfriend got you the kit. You put it to good use.
Yeah, we started making stuff. I don't remember the first batch. I'm pretty sure Robert down at the homebrew shop, you know, sent me home with a honey wheat recipe or something like that. And, you know, I think that's where we got started. I remember there was the wheat recipe, and then there was kind of an IPA that we were doing a little bit of. Mm-hmm. And I remember dry hopping stuff back then with bags, you know, like you do. And, mm-hmm. But yeah, that was a lot going on in my life at that time, and so the memories aren't necessarily crystal clear.
But right, but you started out buying your stuff from Robert.
Oh yeah,
nice.
Yeah, yeah. Kind of instantly. Well, I got a lot of inspiration from him too. Mm-hmm. You know, just him talking about the industry and just fermentation, and so he's a great resource.
Yeah, he was. I've interviewed him for this and. The main reason was I feel that so many brewers, including yourself, have either gone through there and worked there or gone and picked his brain and done stuff. He's an incredibly important part of this scene, and I think for the most part he's overlooked.
Yeah.
But when he's the common thread that you talk to all the brewers in town, and like, well, you know, Robert down at North Corner, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
Robert down at North Corner, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's... Yeah. I think you're right on with that.
He's a good guy.
Yeah.
He'll be 50 soon. No, he just turned 50. So.
Well, he's young. He's a young guy.
Yeah. Exactly. So let's see. We're talking like 2000 to like 2004 or 5, and at some point you moved down to Olympia to work at Fish.
Yeah.
What was that transition like? Were you going? I mean, I assume that your homebrewing abilities and level continued to grow. And did you go down there with the thought of working for a brewery, going pro, or was it just did you just kind of fall into it, or how did that happen?
You know, I did. I guess I would say I sort of fell into it. As I said, I started my career as an autoglass guy, and I was really into cars, and I built hot rods on the side and did a lot of work on cars, and that was sort of my main hobby, and I was home brewing on the back porch of my Humboldt Street house, and you know, all the neighbors were drinking it while I was at work, and I'd be pissed off because I'd come home and the keg was dry, and so I actually decided to take some time off of working, just, you know, do a road trip kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. So I actually quit my job. I saved up money, quit my job, and I rented out my whole house, and I just started to do nothing. And I kind of spent more time around my parents' house, and because my dad had a shop up at the house that, you know, our family house that he wasn't really occupying all of, and so I set up my home brewery in there, and I switched over to all grain at some point before or during that time, and started really getting into all grain brewing, and And at the same time, I was seeing a woman friend that was from Olympia, and she went to college up here and moved back down there. And so I was going down there to see her periodically, and we'd go to the Fish Brewing Company. You know, mm-hmm.
we used to love going there.
Yeah, the Fish Bowl Brew Pub is a great place, and so we'd go in there and hang out and. Eventually started kind of talking with some of the brewers and people that work there, and I was bringing them some homebrew because, you know, that's what you do when you're a home brewer. And
who was down there? Was it Phil or Jen?
So at the time, yeah, Jen was there, Phil was there. Mm-hmm. And in fact, if I'm remembering this correctly, I think Phil was just quitting.
To move to Austin?
To move.
Yeah.
And that's when Tony Powell said, "Hey man, we're looking for a brewer. You should apply." And so I did, not really thinking much. I was like, "Well, yeah, okay. I like Olympia. I got nothing else going on. I like beer. Sure, why not?" So they hired me, and so I kind of moved all my stuff down there and started working there.
And this was what year was this?
This was 2005.
2005.
Yeah, right. I think it was early, maybe March or May or something. Early 2005.
Nice. And so, I remember having a discussion with you at some point, just randomly, that you, even though you were a brewer, I was always under the impression that you were kind of the fix-it guy there. Like yeah. you were the handyman. I mean, with your abilities, you were just the guy that was like, "Oh yeah, I can fix that," or "I can fix that."
Yeah.
Is that true, or was that? Did I misread that?
Well,
were you definitely more of a brewer?
I started there as a brewer. Mm-hmm. You know, they were hiring for a brewer, and then, you know, as I spent time in the brewery and realized that, you know, things needed to be fixed all the time, I started to dabble in helping out with some of that maintenance stuff. And now that I'm remembering, the first day that I worked at Fish Brewing, I worked, I think I spent 13 hours helping to put the last few bolts in the bottling line. They just installed this ridiculous contraption of an antique bottling line. And so, yeah, 13-hour shift was day one. And we got that thing going, and then it was on to wort production and cellaring and things after that. But pretty quickly, Marty, the general manager, saw that I had an ability, you know, a mechanical aptitude, mm-hmm. and he also is a good mechanic, and but busy running the business, and so pretty quickly started to get more heavily involved in the maintenance and particularly operation and maintenance of the bottling line, because that's was really a contraption.
Bottling lines.
Oh, yeah, it was a. They're interesting.
Yeah, that was one thing when Chris and I were talking about Subdued. It was like, there will be no bottling line. None of that.
Yeah.
There will be none of that.
That's what I told myself too.
I know. Yeah, a little foreshadowing. First day, 13-hour day.
Yeah,
using bottling line.
Exactly.
So at some point in there, so this is 2005. Kulshan opened in 2012, and of course, there's all the pre-production work and things that go into a brewery before the day that it opens its doors. At what point, when you were at Fish and you were doing all these things, did you think, you know, I think I want to do this? Or was it a slow burn kind of thing where you're like, you know, I know how to do all this stuff and I want it. Did you want to be a business owner already?
Well, it kind of went like this. The first year or two, I was like, oh, I want to have my own brewery. You know, I think every home brewer, every young brewer,
Everybody has the dream.
At some point, you're thinking, I want to do this for myself. And then a couple of years into it, I went, I want nothing to do with owning a brewery. This is insanity.
Yeah, what kind of fool would do this?
Yeah. And So for quite a while, that was my thought process. I was like, I don't want to do any of this. So, but it kind of swung back the other way at some point. And I think it was just within the last year or so that I was there. I realized, you know, I've done all these different things in the brewery, and I'm, you know, I think the next step for me is to give that a try. Mm-hmm. You know, and I,
yeah, once you had amassed all the knowledge, as the hows.
Yeah, yeah. I wouldn't say I was a master at anything, but you know, kind of touched a lot of different areas in the brewery, from production management to, you know, construction to, you know, making beer. So, yeah, it was kind of a logical next step, I guess, in my mm-hmm. mind.
Right. And so when did you decide to, one, pull the trigger, and two, to do it in Bellingham?
Yeah, so I ended up, you know, the relationship with the woman that I went down there for and with ended up, you know, ending at some point. Mm-hmm. And well, it must have been in 2007 or something like that.
A couple years in.
Yeah, couple years in. And, so I didn't really, you know, I'd made a lot of friends at the brewery and around Olympia and stuff, but there really wasn't anything holding me in Olympia. And I've always kept in contact with all of my friends and family in Bellingham. I mean, it's my home, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of was ready to move back, just regardless of why or how. And then I started thinking, well, maybe I should open a brewery, I thought, well, I think there's room for another brewery up there. Because, you know, at the time it was Chuckanut and Boundary Bay. And
Orchard Street was already gone?
Orchard Street was gone, yeah. Yeah. I forget what year they closed, but it was sometime.
I don't remember either.
Yeah, yeah, it was sometime in those years. I remember my 21st birthday was a keg of Orchard Street stock ale. That's what it was. Nice. And so, yeah, that was good.
Yeah, I remember. For a while, it was just Boundary and Orchard Street, and they were two completely separate entities. Orchard Street's beers tended to be fuller bodied, a little less attenuated, and Boundary's beers tended to be pretty dry, and of course, the obligatory 8-9%. And so there were definitely two camps, you know, people mm-hmm. that really liked the Orchard Street and people that really liked Boundary Bay. Those were the only options at the yeah. time. And then Will came in and changed everything.
But, right, right.
And then you came along. So you opened in 2012, K1, we'll call it at this point, but the original Kulchin on yeah. King Street, which is such a shame that we had moved. That was crawling distance, literally. I had a dream of putting a brewery where Deals Only is, because when I bought that house in 2000, it was empty back there. I was like, oh man,
yeah,
what a commute, you know, like Eric Jorgensen commute, you know, like walk out of your back gate and you're at yeah. work. But then Deals Only moved in, which was, you know, one of the reasons that we moved.
After you lived right behind them.
Yeah 5 o'clock in the morning. One of my favorite, I don't think that you and I talked about this, but somebody, maybe Chris McClanahan, had spoken to you about the day before you opened and how you were walking up and down James Street and it was just crickets.
Yeah.
And you were like, oh, what have I done?
Yeah.
this may be a giant mistake.
Yeah, so I started construction on the Sunnyland Brewery in, I think it was October, or no, September of 2011, and it took me approximately 7 months, I guess, to get it all ready to go. So during
that's pretty good.
Yeah, it was. It was pretty fast, you know. But I was doing it full time, and that's
right. And you had the knowledge.
That's my gig.
Yeah.
So
how was the experience with the city? Because you were only the second or third one to come in. So were they still
kind of like, you want to do what? Where?
Yeah.
Well, we're going to have to think about that. Or what was your experience like? Was it easier because nothing existed, do you think? Or was it more of an uphill battle?
Well, I think in some ways it was probably easier, maybe because of the parking situation. You know, it seems like they're pretty conscious of the parking issues that some breweries can cause. So that there's that, you know, they weren't really ready for that. Although, you know, it hasn't been real bad with Sunnyland. A lot of people bike and walk and, mm-hmm. and stuff. Being in a neighborhood, it's nice that way. But, you know, I wouldn't say that the permitting process was horrible for that project. You know, it's always a major challenge because of all of the different codes. As you know, I'm sure you guys went through all of that stuff. And it really is, it's like trying to find your way on a river that's got a million different channels, and you're trying to find the one way that works. It's like a maze, you mm-hmm. know? And,
yeah.
Just so many different... bathroom requirements, parking requirements, you know, sprinklers, no sprinklers, firewalls, you know, occupancy, different types of occupancy, mm-hmm. and boiler restrictions, and
yeah,
you know, there's just it goes on and on and
not
on.
Not to mention the brewery specific things, like it's a lot of weight. Sugar water's heavy, stainless is heavy,
right.
So you got to make sure that
engineering, yeah, seismic, engineering. And yeah, ADA compliance and. Mm-hmm. Energy codes and
energy usage and water usage. You know, you gotta have an input that's up for the task and a drain that's up for the task.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You can definitely commiserate with that. But you know, all in all, and I was working with an architect that knows those things pretty well, and so you know, thanks to. Some cold hard cash, we were able to negotiate getting a design that the city was okay with, and so yeah, it worked out okay. Although mm-hmm. the you know, I will say the permitting process is always a horrible experience. It just that's just the nature of it. I don't care what you're trying to build.
Right.
So.
Yeah, one of the permitting ladies lives right across the alley from me.
Oh man. You got people like marching down the street with signs every so often.
No, she's pretty mellow.
There's good people down there, and they're just following the I can't really blame the
no, they have a job to
the,
do.
The permit center or the employees there. They just are trying to comply with the law. So mm-hmm. it is what it is.
Yeah. You know, your timing was really good. I'm sure it wasn't intentional. You know, it's one of those things where you look back and you're like, boy, I'm sure glad that I got in when I did. You know, trying to do it now, it seems, would be a lot more difficult to find a good place. And then also to just find your niche. You know, you were fortunate enough to be forward enough thinking to where you're like, you know what, Bellingham could use another brewery and I'm going to do this. And one of Kulshan's strong points is you guys just make good beer. You know, I mean, you do specialty stuff and you branch out, but it's not all about chasing the trends or trying to have a giant barrel program. It's just kind of like a Bridgeport kind of thing. It's like, you know what? We make good, solid beer that people like to drink. And you don't see that much anymore. You know, a lot of new breweries are like, we're going to do all this stuff, and we're going to have all these things, and we're going to make the glitter beer, and we're going to make everything. And you guys are like, you know what? We got a really solid amber, we got a really solid porter, we got a good pale ale, we've got a couple different IPAs. It's just beer.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that? I mean, you were offered that opportunity by opening when you did. But you also haven't reneged on that and tried to chase the trends outside of just doing fun things that you guys want to do.
Yeah, when we started the whole thing, it was you know, I did. I wanted to make beer that just kind of appealed to a lot of different people. You know, you got to kind of hit all of the categories, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Because I wanted to be able to market the beer. I mean, you can't. You know, we don't have deep pockets. It was like, let's get this thing open and start selling beer so that we right. can pay some debt back and keep the doors open. And so, I wanted to do that. But I think above all, you know, we're all beer drinkers at Kolschen, and I think we can all appreciate just a good, solid, balanced beer that you mm-hmm. want to drink. And there's only so many, you know, infused, aged, high alcohol, whatever, glitter beers, like you mm-hmm. say, that you can drink. I mean, those are fun to taste, mm-hmm. but, you know, when you want to drink a couple of pints, maybe you just want a good lager.
I just want a solid beer.
Yeah.
So, as I said, Kolschen makes good beer, and you guys have won awards all over the world. I was looking at your website, and I saw that you guys are quite popular in Australia.
Yeah, we've done pretty well with the Australian International yeah. Awards, and so we've been a part of the Brewers Association Export Development Program for several years.
And, specifically to Australia, or is this just a bigger...
They go all over the world. Familiar with it. So it's a program that the BA has that it helps to develop export capability, I guess, for domestic brewers. And it's really not... We didn't join it thinking we were going to start exporting, because we just don't even come close to making enough beer. That's more for the... you know, the Sierra Nevadas and the Stones of the world. But we joined because it got us access to some international beer competitions that we wanted to compete in. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of competitions in the world, and specifically in the U.S., and I kind of see them as having different levels of credibility. You know, I'm not gonna enter the... you know, the Tennessee County Fair Beer Awards, because it's not, doesn't have much value. But if I can take home an international award, you know, that I'm competing with other big breweries in, that has a lot of value to sure. me. So that's why we've been a part of the Export Development Program, and that's how we got involved in the Brussels Beer Challenge and Australian Awards and a few others. Mm-hmm.
All of that, I know, you know, and of course you've won awards at the GABF, which is the National Great American Beer Festival. But one thing that I noticed, and as somebody who judges this this a lot, although I'm not going to this year because I'm just be getting back from my trip, but the Washington Beer Awards you yeah. guys have done really well in. And I'm just curious as to why you think that is. Do you think that Kolschen as a whole, and you and the brewers that work under you, have kind of a lock on what Washington beer drinkers enjoy and value, or are you just completely flummoxed by it?
Well,
I mean, I'm talking outside of the obvious quality of the beer. Just, you've won a lot of awards at the Washington Beer Awards.
Yeah, I think with that particular competition has gotten stiffer over mm-hmm. the last few years, and those awards are starting to diversify a little bit throughout the breweries. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's happening nationally as well. So the quality of beer in Washington and in the U.S. is getting better.
Yeah, which I agree. 100%.
Is great.
Yeah.
You know, it needed to. I think we were perhaps a little bit ahead of the curve with that in that regard. And it's a continual quest for quality for us. I mean, that's the whole name of the game for us is mm-hmm. make the best beer in the world if we can. Right. So
I think it's true. There's still a lot of mediocre beer out there in Washington state and nationally and globally. You know, some beer has high profile, but may or may not actually be great. And I can think of a few breweries that I won't name, but,
yeah.
I do think that, that's true. And that was something that I kind of wanted to talk to you about too, is just the general competence of your average home brewer and by association, the incoming professional brewers who are coming from that advanced home brewing, knowledge. It just seems like it's gotten a lot higher. And, you know, there's books out there that, you know, you can buy a book on just water chemistry and just yeah. malts. And, you know, whereas, you know, we had Charlie Papazian's book, which is yeah. great, but certainly didn't go into all that detail. And when I got into brewing, I would have never thought of going to brewing school and then getting into brewing. I just kind of fell into it as well. And at some point in there thought, oh, maybe I should go to school for this, and then ended up getting out. But it just there are people that instead of going to college to get their business degree or their theater degree, go to brewing school and come out and like, this is my career, this is what I do. And yeah, it just seems like the level is a lot higher.
Yeah, I think so. And throughout the world, or you know, more specifically Germany and the Czech Republic and you know Central Europe, brewing school is a thing, and mm-hmm. it's been a thing for a long time. And you know, the Wild West over here, kind of, you know, I think the brewing industry sort of started out that way. It's mm-hmm. like, well, we can make beer. This is great. And at some point, the quality has to improve. And I think that a lot of it has to do with the resources that are available to people now. Like you said, Charlie's book was, that's how I learned how mm-hmm. to brew. I read that thing, started making beer, and that was it, you mm-hmm. know. And now, yeah, there is. There's way more resources and online things and ingredients and yeah, suppliers. It's just the industry as a whole has really grown and matured. And to speak to the home brewers getting into the industry, there's a type of home brewer that I sort of look for, and that's the home brewer that does their homework and mm-hmm. that really studies and keeps brewing the same recipe until it's perfect, looks for unbiased feedback on their beers, wins competitions consistently, and also knows how to work hard. Mm-hmm. That's part of it too. So there's more and more of those folks, and thankfully, mm-hmm. and we've hired quite a few home brewers, and some have done really well in the brewery. We've had maybe a couple that didn't, but I'd say by and large, the home brewers that are doing their homework and working hard do well in mm-hmm. the industry.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so too. I think if you're that driven to the point where you perfect your homebrew to the point where you feel that you can take it to a professional brewer and say, hey, don't you want to hire me?
Yeah.
Not every homebrewer does that.
Right.
Yeah, I agree. So let's jump into K2, because you have not one Kulshan location, but two.
Yeah.
And that happened pretty quick. I mean, my recollection of Kulshan opening was, oh, holy shit, like we can barely keep up. When you open, you have no idea what's going to happen. And suddenly you're just struggling to keep IPA on tap. And you just had a little 7-barrel system, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And I remember
it was just a constant state of expansion, you know, with you guys. Absolutely. Like more tanks and then a 10 barrel system. Did you jump to 10 or was 15. It 15? You did go to 15. Yeah. Yeah. And then, and you still have that 15 barrel system at the original.
Yeah, that's correct? Right.
And then K2 opened in 2015?
Yes.
Right. Which 3 years to go from one location, having already ramped that up, and then opening essentially what you saw as a production facility. That's a 30 or is it 50?
It's a 30.
It's a 30.
It's a 30. It's actually a little bigger than that, but we, you know, finished batch size, finished goods batch size, 30 barrels.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was, thanks for noticing how much work that was, because I definitely invested a whole lot of energy for the first number of years with expansion and not being able to keep up and trying to, you know, run a business and hire people and all of those things. And it did, you know, I think back to before we opened, and my first round of hiring was Jim Parker, and he was gonna run the tap room. And my plan was, okay, I'm gonna brew, you know, most of the day, and then I'll go up in the tap room and I'll pour some pints for people, you know, do some samples for people and stuff, and it'll be kind of like, it'll be cool, it'll be mellow, most of the
it'll be social.
Yeah, it'll be fun. I'll be talking to people about beer and I'll, you know, work on the wholesale side of things and really try and grow that, you know, and nothing happened like I thought. I mean, it was an absolute, it was chaos when we opened. The place was so full of people and it was so loud you couldn't even, you know, talk to your friends. It was insanity. And I think we damn near killed Jim Parker the first month we were open.
R.I.P. by the way.
Yeah, exactly. Here's to you, Jim.
Yeah. Cheers, Jim.
Expansion was imminent, because there was just a huge demand, obviously. And so we started looking for a warehouse, actually, because we started canning. That's really what kicked everything into high gear. And so I started looking at spaces that were close. You know, I wanted something that was close to the Sunnyland location, and for obvious reasons. And we ended up stumbling across the building we're in over on Kentucky Street now, and it was just a giant empty warehouse, no windows. You know, weeds growing in the parking lot had been vacant for years, and I thought, this place is 10 times bigger than I can imagine, you know, but it was kind of the only thing available. I think that's right around the same time that legal weed permits were being issued. And so a lot of the smaller commercial spaces like that, or light industrial spaces, were kind of getting eaten up with these, you know, pot facilities. And so I kind of had to bite the bullet on a gigantic building. And so we decided, well, we're not going to be able to keep up with production in our current space, even with this warehouse. So we better just build another brewery.
Right.
And so that's what we did.
Yeah. Again, in 3 years, like growth to not only having a 15 barrel system, but now a 30 barrel system. Was production, I mean, backing up to after you've realized, like, holy cow, we're super popular, we're cranking out a lot of beer, would you say that that's when production became a goal of yours? Because it seems like Kulshan has always been, you started packaging pretty early on, you were on shelves, and, you know, you could find Kulshan in bottles and cans, or I guess just cans. You guys never really bottled, right?
Yeah, we didn't. We didn't bottle. We were doing pre-filled growlers in 32 ounce and in 64s, and we tried to get a bottle, you know, wash and reuse program going with that. And it works in the tap room, but it really was difficult outside of the tap room.
Yeah, for a production thing. I mean, was production a goal early on? Like, I mean, when you're, you know, in the investor phase and talking to investors, were you already thinking expansion or just covering what you already had and what you knew was coming down the pipeline?
You know, I've always kind of had the mindset of production, not necessarily like huge, big production, but just, I love the inner workings of the brewery. I love to see all the equipment working together. It's kind of like, I know this is probably sounds dumb, but like, it's almost like a symphony to me, mm-hmm. you know, all of the pieces work together. And if one thing breaks, it screws up the whole system and it slows things down. And so that concept of manufacturing or brewing and packaging and warehousing too, even to deliveries, even, you know, there's so many things that work together to make it all work. I just love it. And so from that perspective, I've always looked at the brewery in that way. But no, we didn't get into it thinking, oh, we're going to build this second brewery in year two or whatever and start, you know, packaging and distributing throughout the state. That was not part of the plan. I didn't know what to expect. You know, as we were talking a minute ago about when I was building the brewery in the winter and going out into the street on James Street and not seeing any cars up and down and nobody around, you know, I didn't know what to expect.
Right.
And it wasn't until we opened the doors and started selling a lot of beer that I thought, okay, we better make some more beer here because mm-hmm. people are literally angry. Mm-hmm. We ran out of Bastard Cat a few times mm-hmm. and they were angry.
Yeah.
People coming in saying, where's Bastard Cat? Oh, you don't have it? Oh, bye.
Yeah.
And walking out the door. And I thought, geez, this is, people are passionate about this. So we better make more.
What have I done?
Yeah.
Yeah. When K2 came into existence and that whole build out, I remember some challenges with that as well. Not necessarily from a city or permitting view, but from location. There were some water issues, as I recall, or things like that. Not to mention the fact that that was kind of uncharted territory to have a place in that area of town at that time. There were no restaurants or any destination type of places, and people generally, if you didn't live there, you didn't go there because you didn't really have a reason to. Were you at all concerned about that, or were you always thinking, well, this will just be our production facility and then the tap room will just kind of be a bonus onto that?
Yeah, exactly. We built K2 with the intention of having it be our you know, business headquarters and our warehousing and our production. And yeah, the tap room, if people show up and drink some beer, then that's great. That's a nice little bonus. We thought, well, it'd be a good you know, place people could, I don't know, have corporate meetings or something like mm-hmm. that if they wanted. You know, the tap room probably won't be very busy, so it'll be you know, we'll have free space for special events and whatnot. And it's exceeded our expectations. So that's great. And we have been able to use that space for special events. We've really kind of filled up the schedule with, you know, all these different great things that we're doing, whether it's fundraisers or awareness things or just things for fun. So it's worked out really good tap room wise, but yeah, we didn't expect it to.
Yeah. Was it, and maybe I'm wrong, but my recollection is that it was kind of a slow, let's just say public acceptance, I guess, is to getting people to go there. Like, you can come here.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah.
So K1's super crazy crowded. Hey, you know what? Like a 10-minute walk and you're here.
Yeah.
Or a 5-minute bike ride and you're here.
Yeah, exactly. I think it did take a little while for people to find out about it. Mm-hmm. And I think there's even still people around town that don't haven't been there or whatnot.
You hear doom and gloom every once in a while. Like, oh, they're doing it there. Like, oh, what are they
doing? Yeah.
This is belly. It's going to be fine.
Yeah, it's going to be
having
okay.
Having grown up in Houston, you know, it's like, you're going to be fine.
Yeah, and it did have its unique set of challenges with permitting, but also with the LCB, I had an interesting, kind of an interesting situation with the Liquor Control Board on the permitting there. When they said that we weren't going to be able to have kids. And
right.
And so that was not part of the plan. We had fully intended on having all ages at that spot, but they said no, and you know you're not going to argue with them.
Yeah,
really.
You don't open the doors unless you do what they say.
So that's how the no minors thing came to be.
Is it still that way?
It is still that way. You know, and to be completely honest, you know, after months of I won't say litigation because there wasn't real litigation, but just sort of running
discussion.
running it up the ladder at the LCB and talking to different you know, authoritative figures and whatnot. They finally did make a decision that we could have it all ages, but by that time, it had already been established that it was 21 and over, and we kind of decided that we liked it that way. And since the two tap rooms are so close together, you know, people really do have the option of going to Sunnyland if they have their kids. And so we just decided to leave it that way. And but you know, a lot of people ask me why that is, and or they've voiced some serious frustration over it, which was a big deal for the first year. People were genuinely upset. Which, hey, I was too.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah. You can only fight that fight so long. This is a question that I like to ask, especially brewers that are also business owners. And that's about just the brewing industry as a whole right now. It seems to be in a pretty... experiencing pretty serious growing pains. You know, we mentioned Bridgeport, Burnside was just another casualty in Portland, and it seems like there's a little bit of a shakeout happening right now, kind of like a shakedown. A lot of that comes from, at least in my opinion, expansion when people either weren't ready to, or maybe they were a little presumptuous, but that kind of mistake can equal just a complete death knell. You know, you're overextended and all this other stuff is happening and suddenly there's no cash flow coming in and you're done. And it seems like the oh yeah, you know, I'm running a business here aspect of things hasn't ever been more relevant than it is today. And I was just wondering if you could talk a bit about the differences between now and 2012 and 2015 when Culshan got going. And what your thoughts are on, you know, the future of craft beer and local beer in particular.
Yeah, so I guess I would say that it was probably a little easier when we started.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's pretty safe to say. I think people were really ready for another brewery in town and another tap room and specifically kind of in the neighborhood that we started. And so obviously that taproom business is, that's sort of our, you know, that's kind of, I don't want to say bread and butter, but you know, it really helps cash flow.
It's the vault.
Yeah. If you're going to make any, you know, any profit, it's probably going to come from the taproom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, wholesale business is a very low margin, it's a lot of work. It takes a lot of investment up front. So now, fast forward to now, I think it is going to be tough for brewers to open up and have any kind of, you know, organic growth curve like we did. You know, our growth was really fueled by demand, and we really tried to use our own cash flow as much as, mm-hmm. as we could.
Yeah, you knew the demand was, you were responding to a demand, not to a perceived thought of what things should
right.
be.
And we're not a company that has huge deep pockets that can just throw money at something. We've had to calculate everything pretty carefully, and it's risky. Mm-hmm. I've lost a whole lot of sleep at night wondering if things are going to work out. And I remember my dad is one of the investors, I remember saying to him early on, "Dad, I'm really, I'm worried about, this expansion to K2. I don't know if it's a good idea. What happens if it doesn't work? What do we do?" And he said, "Well, what did you start with?" And I was thinking, "Well, nothing really, I guess." Mm-hmm. He says, "Well, what do you got to lose then?" And coming from my dad, that was like, wow.
Yeah.
Because he's a pretty, careful guy when it comes mm-hmm. to investments and things. And so that was sort of him giving me permission to just go for it, man. Mm-hmm. Give it a try. And yeah. So there's been a little bit of, taking some risk. For K2, we did an SBA loan through the bank and through People's Bank. And, we have to make those payments every month, and it's not easy.
Even if the business isn't there, you still have to make payments every month.
Yeah, that's a fixed cost every month, and it's a big number. And mm-hmm. So we're definitely working hard to pay back our debts on that one. But we're still doing it.
Yeah.
It's still working. So to speak to, new breweries opening or just kind of the climate nowadays in the industry, it is interesting for me. I haven't really thought about how long I've been in the industry. What, 14, 15 years now or something?
Yeah.
05. So what's that? Yeah, 13 or 14 years.
Yeah.
So I've seen a lot of change, and I've known some people that were in it in the early 90s, like yourself, and hearing those stories, and there was a big boom and bust. Right,
mm-hmm.
And a
lot first of shakedown happened.
Yep, the first shakedown happened, and I think that we are headed for another one of those.
I agree. I think it's already started.
Yeah, unfortunately, but the thing is that any business person should know that was going to come.
Mm-hmm. That's how capitalism works.
That's right. That's right. And so. We'll see what happens. I think that a lot of the small guys that are in neighborhoods that have a niche following that do most of their business through the tap room will probably be fine.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have maybe huge expectations of profits. I think it's the people that, like you said, maybe expanded too much, too big.
Mm-hmm. Just overextension.
Overextended. Mm-hmm. Yeah, those guys may feel it, especially, when you're doing that, that's distribution, and there's just not enough margin in it to...
Shelves are only so big.
That's right, and there's more and more products on the shelves, more and more beers, and...
Yeah, I'm overwhelmed, and I used to have a beer store, and I can't imagine trying to do... what Elizabeth Station does. I mean, that's what I thought I wanted to be with the bottle shop, but...
Yeah.
I don't...
No, it's insane.
I'm good.
Yeah, there's a lot of different beers on the shelf.
So many.
Yeah.
So many.
So, I firmly believe that quality comes first. If you're making a good, solid product that people can rely on, then you should do okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, look at Sierra Nevada. I feel like Sierra Nevada is the gold standard of craft brewing.
I agree.
They've done it right the whole time, and they still are doing okay. I mean, they may have, you know, had some ups and downs in their total volume throughout the last few years, but I feel like they're still making a good product, and I feel like people still trust the brand. And that's a big deal.
It is a big deal, and it's no small feat. I can think of a lot of other large regional breweries that don't have that cachet, and have made mistakes and maybe had to sell part of their business to other entities.
Agreed.
All right, well, let's take a quick break, and we'll be right back and get into some of the fun questions.
Sounds good. I'm thirsty.
Yeah, me too.
Hey, folks. Just wanted to tell you about our new sponsor, Skagit Valley Malting. I'm a home brewer, and I'm assuming that a lot of you are as well. And so locally sourced products and quality products are important to me, and they're important to a lot of your favorite breweries as well, local and otherwise. Skagit Valley Malting is an independent local craft malt house dedicated to sustainable farming practices and the use of superior maritime grains. Imported and commodity malts make a lot of beer, but craft malt makes craft beer. Using their patented technology, Skagit offers breweries a diverse variety of customizable malts that offer distinction in a crowded marketplace. So why import? They can provide what you're looking for right here, together.
All right, so we're back. That was a very quick break for all, everybody out there, but a nice little beer break for us. So I like to, these are just standard questions that I ask everyone, and they're just meant to be fun and loose and just kind of get a better picture of what you enjoy and where your interests lie as far as beer goes.
All of my deepest secrets.
That's right. That's right. All the deepest secrets. We're just breaking into the bit vault. And I guess the first one is thinking back to your homebrewing days, because you probably don't get up on the brew deck very often anymore, if ever. Are you up there like for specialty stuff?
I go up there every single day, but it's mostly to say good morning to Jack or Wesley. And as far as doing brewing goes, no, not so much. I'll help dump some fresh hops in the in the hop back. But
well, thinking back to your home brewing days, and even just as the owner of Kolchin, what's your favorite beer to brew?
I always liked a good old American style pale ale. I remember. That was kind of a recipe that I worked on home brewing, and it was kind of my favorite one. It was I had success with it, you know. I think it just nice breadiness and good hop character, but not so bitter that, you know, I'm not a huge hop guy.
Yeah,
so
me neither.
Balance is important to me for a good drinking beer, and
couldn't agree more.
So a good pale ale is always solid.
How does the good old boy pale compare to what you were trying to accomplish back then? Is that based on your old recipe or?
Yes.
Yeah.
Loosely, yes.
Of course, it's evolved with new hops and everything.
Sure, but it is. It's to me, it's right on the target. That we're shooting for, or what my palate likes. I had one the other day, and I thought, damn, this is a good beer.
Yeah, I did too. I hadn't had one in a while, and I was at K2 to meet with the film guys. I was like, I have a pale ale.
Yeah.
I haven't had one in a while.
Yeah, it's good. It's easy to drink, and it's got everything you want.
Yeah, I agree. Well, that's kind of... Is that probably transitions into what's your favorite beer to drink? And it can be Kolchin, it can be anybody, anything.
Well, it's not pale ale, although I do like that style. My favorite beer to drink is Pilsner. You know, and the one that we make is fairly hoppy, in my opinion. So we're always sort of...
I just had that too, yeah.
Yeah, it's we're always kind of on the fence or trying... There's a balancing act with, you know, hoppy but not too hoppy. And so we kind of ride that line a little bit, I think, with our Pilsner.
People like hops here, so they don't even taste that hoppiness, probably.
Well, exactly, but and I do, and we do, I should say. So there's a lot of scrutiny that goes into that beer, because, you know, myself and Wes and Jordan and the rest of the team, a lot of people really like that Pilsner, and so mm-hmm. it's one that we put a lot of thought into, and
yeah.
So that's probably my favorite style for drinking. You know, the Czech style pills as well. Ours is more on the German side mm-hmm. of things.
And you just refreshed your palate for those
indeed.
Beers straight from the homeland.
Indeed.
Yeah. Welcome home.
Pilsner Urquell from the wooden tanks in the cellar in Pilsen is to die for.
I would imagine.
It is delicious. So if I had to choose a beer, you know, for the rest of my life, it might be that one.
Nice. The Czech version.
Yeah.
Yeah.
From the source.
Over the German version. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you might have just answered this question too. Drinking wise, what's your guilty pleasure?
Oh, like what am I not supposed to drink as a craft brewer?
Not supposed to drink, but the thing that you might not advertise to everybody, even though you're getting ready to advertise it to everybody.
I've got a few actually, because I like cheap, crappy beer, to be honest with you. I've got a whole lot of opinions on this subject, but one of my, you know, my dad drinks PBR,
mm-hmm.
okay, and it's a great beer. I drink that with him. I have no problems with that.
Yeah, I have no problem with PBR.
You know, Ole Hams. I love Hams if you can find it. I'll drink a Kokanee, although it's not quite as...
It's different. It's a little sweeter, I think.
Yeah. There's a few in that category that I do not like, and not because of any weird political reasons, just because I don't like the... flavor. I don't know if I need to go into that, but these obscure lagers that are just plain, I love. Mm-hmm. So somebody, my neighbor just got back from China and he brought me a Tsingtao mm-hmm. in a can with an old school pull top, like completely pulls off the can. And I drank that and I thought, God, this is great. I love this. I love the skunky green bottle beers, the Heinekens, the, what's that, Buddha beer? There's some kind of a Buddha beer that somebody gave me recently. I don't know. The cheap, crappy lagers, I love those.
Yeah. Yeah, being from Texas, I'm a firm believer that every beer has its place. And if I'm sitting out on a boat in the Gulf of Mexico fishing with my dad, and he hands me a Budweiser, I'm going to drink it.
Yeah.
Is Budweiser my favorite beer? No.
Right.
A fizzy alcohol pop when you're sitting out on a boat?
Yeah.
Very refreshing. You can drink all day, stay hydrated, no problem.
Yeah. Yeah. Bud.
Although with him, it's more Coors.
But Bud Heavy works for me. Bud Light does not.
No.
I don't like the taste.
No.
Mm-mm.
Bud Light, Coors Light, all those, you know, that I drank ad nauseum.
Yeah.
I'm not a fan. I remember we thought we were very refined in our tastes when we were drinking the Michelob Classic Dark.
Oh, yeah.
And I love Michelob. I couldn't tell you the last time I had it. Maybe I don't actually love it, but my memory is that I love it. And the Classic Dark, we called them CDs, and it was before CDs existed. So, every beer has its place. And PBR is, I don't have a problem with PBR.
Yeah.
Got no truck with it. Do you remember the first beer that you ever had?
Absolutely.
Nice. That was with conviction.
Yeah, it was a Rainier in a bottle. Mm-hmm. My dad gave it to me after a long, hard day of cutting firewood.
Nice, as it should be.
And I'm not going to say how old I was for fear that he might get thrown in jail. Yeah. But
statute of limitations is.
Let's just say I was ready for it, and it was delicious. I remember it.
Nice. Nice. That's great. That's probably the most assertive, yes, I absolutely remember. we touched a bit about your home brewing days and then you just kind of falling into working at Fish. But was there a beer that you remember trying where you thought, I need to know how to do that? Is there a beer that flipped that switch where you thought, I want to do that?
That's a tough one. I don't know that I can say that I ever wanted to make one specific beer or a copy of
such. Well, it's not necessarily that. It's just a beer that you tried it and you're like, I want to know how to do this. I want to know how to create. I want to know how to be able to do this.
Got it. No.
All right. That is as valid an answer as any.
I don't think so.
All right. Yeah, and that kind of makes sense given your trajectory. You know, you grew up around your dad homebrewing, and then you started homebrewing, and then you just kind of fell into the Fish thing, and then now you are a successful multi-brewery business owner. That kind of makes sense to me.
Okay.
For what that's worth. Is there a brewing hero or a favorite brewery that you have? And we probably just touched on this with Sierra Nevada a little bit, but it doesn't necessarily have to be them. I mean, is there anybody that not necessarily you model your business practices after, but it's just inspiring?
Absolutely. There's actually quite a few.
Yeah.
You know, we talked about Robert Arzu, mm-hmm. and I mean, got to give that guy some credit for inspiring a lot of people, and Charlie Papazian, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But there's others. Let's see. I was just thinking of somebody. Was it? You know, I've had people in the industry throughout the years. Martin Bills, that was my manager at Fishtail, and he's now with Pelican currently. He was inspirational. A friend of mine that was at Red Hook for many, many years. And of course, you know, Jim Parker.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of people. Skip Madsen. He really was an inspiration when I first started homebrewing, mostly because of yeast, lack of yeast or the need for yeast.
Mm-hmm.
I would bring him a mason jar. He'd fill it up with. I forget what he called it, whether it was, you know, rocket yeast or whatever. He had some nickname for it because it did. It was...
Yeah, well, it's ready to go.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I think he was using Chico yeast, at least at that time. And, mm-hmm. And
which would have been after my time because we only had the 1332.
Yeah, that severely improved my home brewing, was getting a good pitch of yeast. Mm-hmm. And then... You know, Skip took me down in the basement one time and showed me the barrels and, you know, just kind of showed me the inner workings of the brewery. And I thought, wow, this is so cool. I like this.
Yeah.
And so he really was an inspiration.
Yeah, he is a one-on-one basis. Beer. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's great. That's awesome. I had no idea that you and Skip interacted so much.
Yeah, it was a few times, you know, but they were important yeah. interactions for me.
Yeah, so. Clearly. Years later, you remember.
Yeah.
Nice. So this is a, I say this every time, and people that listen to this podcast, assuming that there are people that listen to this podcast, are probably tired of me explaining this, but there was a podcast called The Dinner Party Download that I used to listen to a lot. It's probably the first podcast that I ever listened to. And they had a question that they asked every guest that was, tell us something that we don't know. And it can be about you, it can be about your business, or it could just be some random piece of trivia. But just tell us something that we don't know.
Boy, that's a tough one. Well, there's a few people that know that my uncle Bill used to play with Jerry Garcia and Merle Saunders back in the early 70s.
Wow.
Yeah. My family has a history of being musicians, mm-hmm. and that ended with me.
I was going to ask.
Yeah.
Just play a mean stereo. Yeah.
Let's see. I love racing. I love going fast.
Yeah?
Yeah, I had a drag car for a while that I would take to the track, different tracks, and nice. Do drag racing. And I built a big V8 for it and had slicks on it and everything, and that was a lot of fun. And I've always, you know, raced dirt bikes, mm-hmm. ridden dirt bikes, and so going fast has always been a fun hobby of mine.
Maybe that explains the progression of culture.
Maybe.
That's funny. I've much to Steph's chagrin, I came clean just like last week or something. I was like, you know what? I have a secret to tell you. I've kind of started following Formula One. Like, I don't know where it started, but
yeah,
I could kind of tell you who all the drivers are.
Oh, well, that's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. It just went from 0 to 60, so to speak. So, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Bubby. Yeah.
Love that. Yeah, nobody speaks English, yeah. Except they all speak English better than I speak any foreign language.
Right.
Yeah. These are kind of the quick fire questions here. What's your favorite grain?
Weirmann Pilsner malt.
Yep, that's a solid choice and makes sense. What about hop?
Cascade.
The most consistent answer. So versatile, so beautiful, and so delicious.
Oh, maybe I should pick a different one.
No. That's most, I would say most people that have any extended brewing experience say Cascade, and usually without much hesitation.
Yeah.
It's just so versatile and so lovely.
Well, and it's such a workhorse, mm-hmm. you know. That's what we use the most of, mm-hmm. and yeah, like you say, it's versatile. And mm-hmm. if I really thought about it, maybe I could convince myself it was Czech saws or something mm-hmm. like that. But
yeah, what's your favorite yeast? And I'm excited to hear your answer since you guys make Belgians, Pilsners, all kinds of stuff.
Well. You know, it depends on whether you're making an ale or a lager.
I know. Right? All these are unfair questions.
Yeah. Our workhorse yeast throughout the years has been the 1056, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's the one that that I've used the most of. And mm-hmm.
So is there any advice for people who are listening to this, who are thinking to themselves, I want to open a brewery. I want to be where he is right now. What advice, just generally speaking, would you have for somebody who's thinking about taking their hobby to the next level and or just opening a brewery and having to hire all of the magic that happens?
I remember Chad mentioned, and I had heard you told this to me and Chris when we met about Subdued as well, is you said, if you're a brewer and are thinking of opening a brewery and think that you're going to be up on the brew deck every day and be running a business, that is complete silliness. That is not going to happen. If you're doing the business part of things correctly, that is not going to happen. And I remember that. Like, if you want to be a brewer, go be a brewer. If you want to be a business owner, be a business owner.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I suppose if we're going to delve into what it might look like on a day-to-day for somebody that does open a brewery, you know, take a look at what it is you want your job to be for the next some amount of years.
Foreseeable and, future, yeah.
Yeah, if you want to be a business operator, then there's plenty of opportunity to do that. If you want to be a brewer, perhaps you want to find somebody that can help run the business. I think both can be done, but there tends to be enough other things and administrative responsibilities that certainly drug me out of the brew house immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm, you know, I don't exactly have a, I'm not so attached to brewing. That wasn't necessarily my strongest skill set to begin with, and I recognize that. So it wasn't a huge loss for me mentally to not be able to brew beer,
mm-hmm.
but it definitely wasn't what I expected either. You know, the business absorbs a lot of time and energy, and that's definitely part of it. And one thing that I've told people in the past is, you know, I certainly got into the business being cautious about failure or, you know, not taking too big of risks or things like that. But so planning for
contingencies.
Yeah, having contingencies. But also what I didn't consider was planning for success.
Right.
That's something that people should do. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, breweries tend to be successful assuming you make a good product and assume you can run a business.
Yeah. Yeah, so kind of having a vision for the future, I guess, is helpful. And it's not, at least for me, it's not that easy to do.
No. Well, you've had to do it on the fly. I mean, you were early enough in on the local scene to where it was just necessary.
Yeah.
Expand or go backwards.
Right. Well, and at least for us, I feel like the business sort of grew its own legs or kind of turned into a freight train that was running away a little bit as far as growth goes and just trajectory. So, you know, trying to get the tracks laid down in front of the train is mm-hmm. is sometimes the job.
Mm-hmm.
Because I, you know, honestly, I have a wonderfully talented staff that is, you know, better at most of the things that we do than I am. And there's no way that I as an individual can do everything. And so learning how to give those responsibilities away to the right people and letting them do those things that's what's allowed us to have success. If I was trying to do everything myself, I'd be a crazy person, probably mm-hmm. in an insane asylum by right. now. So letting go and trusting the process with the people that you have is important.
Trusting your hiring process. Like, yes. I hired you for a reason to do this job, and I'm going to let you do that job.
Right.
Yeah, that's tremendous advice. Because, yeah, as a control freak,
yeah,
I can say that it doesn't always work.
You yeah, know,
you can
right.
only do so much. Only do so much.
I was getting a haircut down at Sonny's Barber Shop a couple of years ago, and right behind the brewery there. Great barber shop, by the way. Sonny's fantastic. But she has another guy that works in there sometimes, and he was cutting my hair, and he says, "Oh, you want me to do a beard trim for you?" And anybody who knows me knows I've had the same exact facial hair for years. And I said, "No way, man. That's one of the very few things in life I actually have control over."
Yeah. Yeah. It's sometimes the little things. So like your life is this big picture, but it's like, no, I can control that. Yeah. At least that is my domain.
I can trim my beard and I'll still screw that up.
But at least you did it.
That's right. And it'll grow back.
Yeah. Yeah.
With gray.
Yeah. Yep. I just shaved today, but if I still had this, it's coming. It's coming out for sure.
Somebody told me one time that gray hair happens about 7 years after the stressful event in your life. And we're about 7 years in, and guess what? I don't know if it's true, but that's what I was told.
Yeah. Well, in that case, I wonder about my mom, because she was completely white by the time...
You were seven.
Probably. Probably, yeah. Not too long after, actually. Yeah, I remembered her with darker hair, but I don't think my brother ever did. Well, dude, this has been a lot of fun. And again, thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
Taking the time out, and you're obviously super busy. And hopefully I asked decent questions, but is there anything that you want to add that I didn't cover or I didn't ask?
No, I mean, I guess just more general thoughts about the current marketplace. I don't know. I call it a community.
Yeah.
The current community of beer and the beer industry. It's kind of cool what's happened in Bellingham. You know, if you would have asked me 8 years ago whether
we'd
have
James Street
10 or 15 breweries in town, I'd be like, probably not.
Me too.
Maybe we could support that many, but it's hard to imagine. And so it's cool to see so many people getting into it, and so much enthusiasm behind beer. It's kind of a dream come true for a lot of us who've been in the industry for some amount of years, because it wasn't always like that. Mm-hmm. I know when I got into it, it was this sort of mysterious thing that people didn't like IPAs, and mm-hmm. a lot of the beers we were making were just people couldn't comprehend the flavors and they didn't like them.
The education part isn't as hard as it used to be.
Yes, and that's the one thing that I will say about Bellingham is that the beer drinkers have grown,
mm-hmm.
and they're more educated now, much more educated about beer than they ever have been, and it's so cool to see people come in and be like, "Yeah, I want that Goza," mm-hmm. because they know what it is.
Right.
And a few years ago, they didn't, mm-hmm. and so that's really cool. And people's palates are expanding, and just the level of beer knowledge is so much more. So keep drinking beer, people.
Yeah, absolutely. It's good for you. Yeah. It has food value.
That's right. That's right.
I get my B-complex vitamins through that.
And my father doesn't drink water either, because beer has water in it. So
there you go. It's 90% water.
That's right.
Nice. Well, cool, man. Well, cheers.
Yeah, cheers.
Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dave.
7-year gray hairs, fast cars, and cheap beer. I think we covered some ground there. A big thanks to Dave for taking the time to sit down and chat. I always enjoy hearing breweries' origin stories and the tales that led to them. As always, if there's someone you'd like me to sit down with, please let me know. I have a new email address that has yet to be used, and you can reach me directly at dave@taptrail.com. So hit me up with questions or comments. They can even be ones about the podcast if you want, or just general life lessons. If you enjoy Tapped In, please take a moment to rate us with all the stars on your podcast service of choice. It makes a big difference in where we can be heard and whether this experiment will be able to continue or not. I've got some exciting conversations scheduled, so make sure and subscribe so you don't miss out. The goal is to release one per month, so trying to keep up with that. Bellingham Beer Week is coming up in a couple weeks, so make sure to do your liver stretches, people. Have fun and don't be dumb. Be sure and check out the Tap Trail website and pick up your beer passport so you can fully appreciate all of the wonderful things beer that Bellingham has to offer. Thanks again for listening and spreading the word, and I'll talk to you soon. Cheers.